So let's start with a line that I think pretty much everyone knows. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light.
Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2. Instantly recognizable.
It is, isn't it? I mean, even if you've never set foot in a church, you know this line. It's cultural shorthand.
Mm. It evokes a very specific feeling. You hear it and you think of, what, Christmas carols?
Christmas carols, nativity plays with kids in bathrobes, maybe Handel's Messiah on the radio. It has this whole highlight reel attached to it.
It feels very specific, very warm, almost nostalgic, safe, you know, resolve.
Exactly. It's the ultimate cozy verse. But today, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to strip all that coziness away.
Okay.
We're taking that ancient verse, and we're basically airdropping it into a completely different reality.
We're moving from the Judean hillsides to the bustling, complicated streets of modern India.
Yeah, we're looking at this fascinating paper. It's titled Light for Those in the Shadows by Vinod Shimron S. And I'll be honest, this source completely rewired how I read that text.
How so?
Well, the author argues that for certain communities in India, this isn't some poetic metaphor about a holiday. It's a survival manifesto.
And to really get the weight of that, you have to look at who the author is. Vinod Shimron. He's not writing this from some ivory tower.
Right. He's a doctoral research scholar in Christian theology. Mm. But his background, it's in the trenches.
It is. The notes say he was the thematic lead on diversity, equity, and inclusion at the Solidarity Foundation in Bangalore.
And the Solidarity Foundation, that's an NGO, right?
Right. And they work directly on the ground with gender and sexual minorities. We're talking about communities on the absolute margins of Indian society.
So when he looks at this ancient text, he's looking at it through their eyes.
Exactly. He's asking a really profound question. What does light even look like when you are fighting for your life?
And that's really the mission for this deep dive. We want to understand how this author flips the script on a 2,000-year-old prophecy.
He claims that for three specific communities, the Jogappas, the Kothis, and the Sivashaktis, this text is a living word that speaks directly to their daily struggle.
And it all starts by redefining that very first word.
Darkness.
Let's pause there. Because in a standard reading, or even just in pop culture, darkness means something bad. It's sin, ignorance, evil.
It's the classic binary. Light is good, dark is bad. But Shimron stops us right there. He says, for queer people in India, darkness isn't a moral failing.
What is it then?
It's a zip code. It's a sociological location. It's the shadows where society forces them to live.
So it's not something inside them. It's the environment placed around them.
Precisely. And he uses the Jogappa community to make this point crystal clear.
Okay, let's unpack the Jogappas, because for a listener who's maybe not from South Asia, that term might be unfamiliar. Who exactly are they?
The Jogappas are a traditional community, mostly in northern Karnataka and southern Maharashtra. Physically, they are persons assigned male at birth. But you can't just categorize them as men. Their whole identity is defined by a religious dedication. They are married to the goddess Yalama.
So they exist at this intersection of religion and gender identity.
Correct. They don't fit into the Western binary of male or female. And this is where that concept of darkness becomes so real. Shimron points out this brutal paradox in their lives.
I was really struck by a quote in the paper. A Jogappa tells the author, "We are called children of Yalama, but to the world we are untouchables twice over."
Twice over. That phrase just does so much heavy lifting, doesn't it? It exposes all the layers.
Break that down for us. What does twice over actually mean in their daily life?
So first you have caste. Many Jogappas come from Dalit or lower caste backgrounds. So historically, in the traditional social hierarchy, that already marks them as untouchable.
That's the first layer.
That's layer one. And then the second layer is their gender. Because they don't conform, because they live outside the heteronormative family structure, they faced just intense transphobia and exclusion.
So marginalized by birth and marginalized again by their gender expression.
That is the darkness Shimron is talking about. It's a space of total social exclusion.
But here's the twist that the author highlights. Despite being pushed into those shadows, these are the very people who power the religious festivals.
This is the fascinating contradiction. When the festival of the goddess Yalama happens, who is carrying the deity on their head, who's dancing in the procession?
It's the Jogappas.
It's the Jogappas. So the people who aren't allowed in polite society suddenly become the center of the entire spiritual universe for a few days.
In that moment, the people who are supposedly living in the dark become the source of the light.
Shimron says they embody divine power. So when Isaiah writes, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light," We usually think that people looked up and saw God coming.
Right, that some external light source appeared.
But Shemron says, no, look closer. The Jogapas are the light. Their resilience, their devotion, their very existence shines a light in the middle of that darkness.
That's a huge theological shift. You're not bringing light to the margins. You're finding it in the margins.
And he backs this up. He brings in Marcella Althaus Reed, a pioneer in what's called indecent theology.
Indecent theology. That sounds, well, provocative.
It's meant to be. Her core idea is that traditional theology is obsessed with decency, middle-class values, respectability. She argued that God is actually found in the indecent places.
In the slums, in the bodies that society rejects.
Exactly. So if you want to find the divine, don't go to the cathedral. Go to where the Jogapas are dancing. He also cites Patrick Cheng.
Another queer theologian.
Right. And Cheng argues that queerness itself is a form of revelation because religions are often obsessed with binaries, good, bad. Male-female queerness breaks those down.
And in doing so, it reveals something about God.
It reveals that God can't be put in a box. So the Jogapas, by living between genders, are revealing something a binary view just can't see.
It reframes their identity from a problem to a revelation.
It completely restores their agency. They aren't victims, they are messengers.
Which brings us to the next part of the prophecy. We move from the light to the burden. Isaiah 9.4, for the yoke of their burden, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken.
And this is where Shemron introduces the Kothi community.
Okay, so how do the Kothis differ from the Jogapas?
Well, while the Jogapas have that specific religious dedication, Kothis are generally defined more by gender expression and class. They're usually working class queer persons, often effeminate men or gender fluid individuals.
And they don't have that cover of a religious role.
Exactly. So the yoke they carry is described as being particularly heavy. And the author gets really specific with the Hebrew words here.
Right. He breaks down mota, shechem, and shibbet.
The yoke, the shoulder, the rod. And he says, no, these aren't just metaphors for sin. These are literal systemic instruments of domination.
So what does that look like for a Kothi in a city like Bangalore today?
It's visceral. The yoke is economic exclusion, being denied jobs because of how you talk, forcing many into sex work just to survive. The rod isn't a metaphor. It's the police baton. It's violence on the street.
It's being kicked out of your family home.
That is the rod of the oppressor.
The verse promises this rod will be broken. And we usually think of that in big political terms. Protests, changing laws. But the author points to something much quieter.
This was my favorite part of the paper. He defines the breaking of the rod as the quiet persistence of queer joy.
That's a beautiful phrase. But practically, how does joy break a system of oppression?
Think about what the oppressor's goal is. It's to crush your spirit, to make you feel ashamed and isolated.
So joy is the ultimate rebellion.
It is. The paper describes how Kothis, often rejected by their biological families, form their own kinship systems, chosen families.
The text mentioned rented rooms.
Right. They pool their money to rent small rooms. And inside those four walls, the rod of the oppressor doesn't exist. They cook together, they share food, they watch movies.
It sounds almost mundane.
But in a world that demands your erasure, hanging out is a radical act. There's a quote in the text from a Kothi person that just stops you. We have learned to laugh together so that society cannot crush us.
Laughter is a shield.
By refusing to be miserable, by refusing to internalize the shame, they are snapping the rod.
Now, the author does mention the big public wins, too. It's not all private resistance.
True. He references the 2018 decriminalization of Section 377. That was the colonial era law that basically criminalized queer existence.
A massive legal breaking of the yoke.
Huge. Mm. And he mentions the 2019 Pride March in Nagaland.
Nagaland is in Northeast India, right?
Yeah.
Why is that march so significant?
It's very significant. Nagaland is a region with a strong, often conservative Christian presence. For a queer collective to march and declare, we are here, we are home, that is a public shattering of silence.
It's taking the private joy from the rented room and flooding the streets with it.
Yes, and he connects this idea of present tense liberation to a theologian named Arvind P. Nirmal.
The father of Dalit theology.
Right, and Nirmal's argument was revolutionary. He said, for oppressed people, you can't just promise pie in the sky when you die.
The idea that you'll get your reward in heaven.
Nirmal rejected that. He said, salvation has to be measured by liberation here and now. Justice needs to show up in history, not just in the afterlife.
So for the Kothi cooking dinner in that rented room, that is salvation. That is the breaking of the yoke.
It's the realization of the prophecy in real time.
So we've seen the Jogapas as the light and the Kothis breaking the yoke. Now we move to the Siva Shaktis, and maybe the most famous part of the passage, the titles. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace.
And those titles usually conjure up images of a king on a throne, right? Power, domination, majesty.
But Shimron says that's a misreading.
He argues that in the original context, a title like Prince of Peace isn't about military victory, it's about mishpat and tzedakah.
Justice and righteousness.
Exactly. The peace being promised isn't just the absence of war, it's the presence of justice. And he connects this title, Prince of Peace, to the Siva Shaktis.
Okay, so who are the Siva Shaktis?
They are transgender women who see themselves as devotees of both Shiva and Shakti, the male and female cosmic energies. But their role in society is, well, it's complicated.
How so?
On one hand, they face the same mockery and harassment as other groups. But on the other, they're seen as having this mystical power. People believe their curse is dangerous, but their blessing is incredibly potent.
So the same people who would harass them on the street might invite them into their homes to bless a newborn baby.
That's the contradiction. They're called upon at weddings, at childbirths. There's a quote from a Siva Shakti elder. Society laughs at us, but they also know when we bless, it comes true.
It's such a strange dynamic. Reverence born out of fear, not respect.
It is. But Shimron says, look at what the Siva Shakti is actually doing. When she claps her hands and speaks a blessing over a child, she is mediating peace. She's speaking wholeness into a life.
So she is enacting the role of the Prince of Peace.
Yes. And think about the subversion. The Prince of Peace isn't a king in a palace. It's a trans woman in a doorway, blessing a family that might not fully accept her. She's offering something they need but can't produce themselves.
That forces you to rethink what peace even requires.
He brings in the theologian Virginia Remy Mullencott, who said you can't have peace without justice.
So when the Siva Shakti asserts her right to bless, when she claims that spiritual authority, she's creating justice for herself.
She's carving out a space for herself in the divine order. She's saying, I am not a mistake. I am a conduit of God's blessing. That is an act of justice. And by doing that, she brings a kind of peace.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really moving to see how the author maps these three communities onto this ancient text. But he doesn't just leave it there. The final section is a call to praxis.
Right. Praxis, which just means action guided by theory, walking the walk. And remember, he's writing this for a seminary, Bishop's College. He's talking to future priests and theologians.
And he's telling them they're looking for God in all the wrong places.
He challenges the whole geography of theology. He says we need to get out of the library and the sanctuary.
So where does he send them?
He says, go to the Jogapas festival, go to the Kothi's rented room, go to the Siva Shakti's blessing ceremony.
It implies the real experts on God aren't the ones with the PhDs.
Exactly. The experts are the ones living the reality. He quotes Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, who talks about the Basileia of God, the kingdom of God.
But not as a monarchy up in the clouds.
No, as the empowerment of the oppressed right now, a different kind of governance.
So the argument is that the queer struggle for dignity is the gospel.
That's the core of it. He's saying that queer lives aren't a side issue for the church to debate. They are the central text. If you want to understand Isaiah 9, don't read a commentary. Look at the life of a Kofi surviving in Bangalore.
He calls the paper a queer liberative manifesto.
And a manifesto demands action. It demands we stop looking up at the sky for a savior and start looking around us.
We've covered a lot of ground. We started with a Christmas carol and we ended up here.
That's the power of changing the context. The picture changes completely.
So if we boil this down, what's the big takeaway? Why does this matter to someone listening right now, wherever they are?
I think it matters because it changes where we look for hope. We're conditioned to look for light in centers of power, in governments, in wealth, in success stories.
In people who seem to have it all together.
Right. And Shimron is telling us that the real light, the light that actually breaks the darkness, is shining in the shadows.
It's shining in resilience.
It's shining in the ability of people to find joy when the world gives them every reason to despair. That quiet persistence we talked about, that is the most powerful force in the room.
And it suggests that breaking the yoke isn't reserved for heroes. It happens every time someone asserts their dignity.
Every time someone says, I am worthy or I am home, the yoke cracks a little bit more.
That is a really powerful place to land. It makes you scan your own environment differently.
It does. It makes you ask, who am I overlooking?
So here's a final thought for you to carry with you. The author challenges us to find the divine in indecent places. If we accept that premise, that light and divine presence are found in the margins, then what shadows in your own community are you currently ignoring?
Mm.
And if you dared to look closer, what kind of light might be shining there that you've been missing all along?
That's the question.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
See you next time.